Our 12 o'clock presentation is by Dan Levitt. Pat Gillick and His Many Rivers, One General Manager's Approach to Gaining an Edge.
So when Mark Armour and I were putting together the book that we've just had come out this spring, In Pursuit of Penance, one of the themes that came out of the book was that teams that have been successful over long periods of time very often and almost exclusively come up with something new, a different approach, a different way to look at the world. And even if it's just sort of a small little thing, something can make a big difference over a long period of time. And so my presentation today is on one general manager's attempt to try and create some sort of a strategic advantage over a long period of time. And that is Pat Gillick, and he had a saying that he looked for many rivers running into one, which was basically his metaphor for go out and find the best ball players wherever you can and think creatively about that process. So a quick overview on Pat Gillick. Gillick spent the 60s as a scout in the Houston Astros organization. In the mid-70s, he moved on to the Yankees as the scouting coordinator, and he became one of their key advisors there. It was Gillick who spent a lot of time pushing to acquire Willie Randolph. He was one of the key proponents of trading Bobby Bonds for Ed Figueroa, and a couple of those trades obviously were important in the Yankees growth. Peter Bavese, who was hired to be the executive to run the Blue Jays in 1976 as president, hired Gillick away. He likes to tell the story that George Steinbrenner was extremely unhappy to lose Gillick, who was actually still under contract. He called the president of Labatt's, the brewery, which was one of the owners of the Blue Jays, and said, you know, you can't be hiring these people away from me. I want you to fire Peter Bavese for that, for hiring one of the great young executives in baseball, to which the president of Labatt's told him, fired? No, we're going to give him a raise. So that was one of the early pushbacks on George Steinbrenner. Once he was the GM in Toronto, quick overview here, he built a great franchise. The team won at least 86 games for 11 straight years from 1983 through 1993, which if you guys have looked at it, there's not a lot of teams that can do that. He then went to Baltimore, where he went to two straight American League Championship Series. He went to Seattle, again, a team that had finished below 500 2 years in a row. And in Seattle, he set the all-time American League win record with 116 wins. They went to two American League Championship Series there. He then went to Philadelphia in 2006 for his final venture, where he won the World Series in 2008. And then finally, he was elected into the Hall of Fame in 2011. So Gillick's approach was essentially to hire great scouts and then go try and find players in addition to the usual avenues, look in non-traditional places. And again, his saying was, one needs to fish in many waters. And this goes well beyond the draft. One thing he did is he brought in two longtime scouts to be his key advisors, which is something that a lot of teams didn't have at that time. Bobby Maddock was one of the great scouts. He had signed, was involved in the signing of Frank Robinson, Veda Pinson, Kurt Flood, and Gary Carter before he went to the Blue Jays. And then Al Amakia was a long-term scout with the Phillies and the Braves organization. So he went out and he decided that he needed these scouts if he was going to find a great organization or build a great organization. Well, one of the things that he did early on was the mastery of the Rule 5 draft. As many of you know, the Rule 5 draft is for veteran minor leaguers who are not put on the 40-man roster. Typically, the players available are not particularly good, or the team would have put them on the 40-man roster to begin with. This is a list of five players that Gillick got while in Toronto through this Rule 5 draft, which is pretty much better than anybody else has ever done by quite a wide margin. The first guy he drafted was Willie Upshaw. George Bell he got through the Rule 5 draft. Manny Lee, Jim Gott, Kelly Gruber was a key acquisition. So again, here he is. And in fact, because of this, teams actually started looking more seriously at who they protected in the Rule 5 draft. To some degree, before Gillick, people just didn't really take it seriously. Gillick made this a real way to find ball players. Another way that he found ball players was in the mid-80s, there was this funny free agent compensation draft. You guys may remember if you lost a free agent, the teams that had signed a free agent had to put some guys into a pool who you could draft. And he drafted a minor leaguer before the 1985 season named Tom Henke. And Henke came up in the middle of the 1985 season and had such an effect on the division race that Henke actually ended up finished 20th in the MVP race that year. So he was always looking for some way to find ball players. Probably one of the key things that you can remember about Gillick and what he tried to do was that Gillick really established one of the first true pipelines to the Dominican Republic for ball players. Gillick first got to know Epi Guerrero, the great Dominican scout, when he was in Houston. And in fact, the two of them together signed Cesar Cedeño back in 1967 and had a long-term relationship. Guerrero worked for the Yankees for a while Gillick was there. And in the late 70s, Guerrero set up the first what I'll call sort of a proto Dominican Academy, where he had about $8,000. He brought a little building to house kids and sort of built a rudimentary ball field. A couple years later, the Blue Jays teamed up with him. They funded that, and they really created what became the first Dominican Academy in the early 80s. Players that came out of that, Tony Fernandez, Carlos Delgado, Damaso Garcia, Junior Felix, Kelvin Escobar, and the relationship that Gillick and Guerrero had also led to Guerrero recommending players who were already in the majors. It was because of Guerrero's recommendation that they traded got Alfredo Griffin and Juan Guzman, and he was the one who suggested that George Bell in the Rule 5 draft as the veteran minor leaguer would be a smart guy to pick up. And just as an example of or a data point for the fact that the Blue Jays were fairly progressive in trying to find this is that in 1985, the first year the Blue Jays won the division, they had fewer plate appearances from Caucasian ball players than any other team in the majors. The other thing that he did a little less successfully was to speculate on multi-sport athletes. Again, Gillick was trying to find ball players wherever he could. Danny Ainge was a 15th round draft choice, so a pretty good flyer in 1977. Gave him a $300,000 bonus and let him play basketball at Brigham Young. After Ainge was done at Brigham Young, he hadn't obviously hit very well in the Blue Jays organization, and he wanted to go play basketball. The Celtics drafted him. And I don't know if some of you guys remember this, but there was a very contentious, there was actually a couple of court cases before, Ainge was actually ruled to belong to the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays eventually decided that you didn't want a player who didn't want to play for you, and they allowed him to buy out his contract. But I think Gillick, who probably gets along with everybody, I think there's probably still a little animosity between him and Ainge to this day. Another player that didn't work out was Jay Schrader, who they drafted in the first round a couple of years later. They gave Schrader a $100,000 bonus and let him stand and play football at UCLA. Schrader never really learned to hit. Gillick claims that it was because he just never really applied himself to baseball. And then lastly, again, I'm a little ahead of the story here, but Darnell McDonald was a Orioles draft choice when he was at the Orioles in the mid-90s. And McDonald had a scholarship to the University of Texas, was going to go play football there. And Gillick gave him one of the largest bonuses ever to play baseball. Again, that one didn't work out. But I think the idea here is that he was trying to use his draft picks, especially in the case of Ainge, where it was a late-round draft choice, to find players wherever you could find them. He also, along the same vein, pursued hard-to-sign amateurs. John Olerud was College Player of the Year as a sophomore at Washington State. he said he, as after his junior year, you know, he had the brain aneurysm. He didn't play all that much his junior year, and he said he was going back for his senior year. Gillick actually went out there 9 times to visit with him and his family, try and get Olerud comfortable with the Blue Jays. They used a third-round draft choice on Olerud, so again, a fairly, you know, not a first or a second rounder, and they managed to get Olerud in the third round by giving him a high bonus. 2 years later, Sean Green they drafted. Green wanted to stay at Stanford for his senior year. They gave Green a very large, but one of the highest bonuses ever back in, that was in 1991. And again, with Green, they let him go back to college in the fall, even while he was signed with them. Green went to Stanford. Well, another thing that he did, which lots of players do, what lots of GMs do, but sometimes there's a twist, was some great trades. The trade that got landed Fred McGriff was one, Gillick is probably his favorite trade. The Yankees wanted Dale Murray, and they had sort of worked out a trade for Dave Collins and Mike Morgan from the Blue Jays going to the Yankees. Gillick did what many great general managers often do. They asked for a young throw-in in the trade. He didn't just want to ask for Fred McGriff, however, because he felt that the Yankees would just say no. So he said he asked for two other young players, Don Mattingly and Dan Pasqua, who he knew that Steinbrenner would never give up. Pasqua partially because he was a New Jersey kid and Steinbrenner liked having the local guys on the team. Steinbrenner, they hemmed and hawed for a while. Finally, Steinbrenner called back and said, you can't have either of those, but I'll give you this McGriff guy who's down in A-ball. At least this is the way Gillick tells the story. Gillick said something along the lines of, you know, I'm not really sure, let me call you back. So he hung up, waited the appropriate 15 minutes, called back and said, okay, I'll take McGriff. And that's how Gillick got Fred McGriff from the Yankees. He also traded for Devon White in the late 80s. And then maybe his best trade, he landed Robbie Alomar and Joe Carter for McGriff and Tony Fernandez, which is really one of the key trades that made the Blue Jays probably the best team in the American League, at least in the early 90s. Gillick never really used free agency. The Blue Jays were really run on a fairly tight budget. They were owned by Labatt's. Labatt's wanted to run them like a business. That was a key point of the way they ran it. But once Sky Dome opened in 1989, he had a bunch of money to go out and try and find ball players, and that changed the paradigm for what he could do with the Blue Jays. And one of the things that he did, which maybe came out later, because here he was obviously signing some older players, but he had a 3-year contract limit. He would not sign any free agent for longer than 3 years. That was part of the stuff in collusion, but when collusion ended, teams started signing players for longer than that. But Gillick really said, I'm not going to saddle myself with older players for longer than 3 years. Before the 1992 season, so in 1991 they won the division, lost in the division series. Gillick was decided they were going to try and go for it and get this thing done. They signed Jack Morris and Dave Winfield before the 1992 season, and they went on to win the World Series. The next year, Winfield left, and in his place, Gillick signed Paul Molitor. So you can see he was fairly successful in filling in the gaps when he finally had a chance to go with free agents. Well, he retired after the 1994 season. He'd had some health scares, and he'd been at Toronto a long time, wanted a different challenge. So he went to Baltimore in late 1995 to prepare for the 1996 season. The Baltimore team had a lot of really good players, Cal Ripken, Rafael Palmeiro, but they had some very significant holes. And I think that here what Gillick did is he clearly identified his holes. They needed a second baseman, a third baseman. They needed to fill in the bullpen, and they could use one more starting pitcher, and that's what they did. They signed Robbie Alomar. They signed B.J. Surhoff. He got Randy Myers and Roger McDowell, so he filled in there, and then he traded for David Wells, an ex-Blue Jay. Obviously, Robbie Alomar was a Blue Jay, too, and he managed to sign Robbie Alomar at the height of his career at only a 3-year contract, which, when you think about it, is at the time was something Gillick wanted to do because who knew how these players were going to be in the future. And this is another thing that he did is if he liked a player, he would continue to go after them. Alomar here, Wells, and there's several more examples of that. He then went to Seattle. He got tired after 3 years of working for Peter Angelos. He got tired of that, retired again. Seattle had their new stadium. They wanted to rebuild a team. And in Seattle, they had just finished below 500 2 years in a row, and he came to that team. He hoped to keep both Alex Rodriguez and Ken Griffey Jr. Jr. he had to trade at midseason. Rodriguez, they hoped to sign after the season, but obviously, you know, they thought they were offering a big contract at something like 3 years for $60 million, which would have been a record. As you know, Rodriguez signed that 10-year, $252 million contract, and they weren't even close. But he filled in around it. I mean, he basically, maybe you can't do this today, but he went out and he signed a whole boatload of free agents before the 2000 season and then a couple more before the 2001 season. So before the 2000 season, he signed Olerud, obviously one of his favorite players. Paul Beeston, the president of the Blue Jays, said he used to cry every time Olerud got a hit. Mark McLemore and Stan Javier, who were a couple of switch hitters. McLemore, an on-base machine, and manager Lou Piniella loved switch hitters. Aaron Seeley, and then in the bullpen, Jeff Nelson and Arthur Rhodes. Arthur Rhodes was one of the few 4-year contracts he had to sign. And then the next year he signed Brett Boone before the 2001 season. And, of course, most famously, he found himself another river to fish in. He signed Kaz Sasaki before the 2000 season, who became Rookie of the Year as the relief pitcher. And then Ichiro he signed before the 2001 season. Ichiro before the 2001 season as one of the obviously key players. And, you know, today this looks like a no-brainer, but one of the interesting things about this is that up to this time, no Japanese position player had ever really succeeded in the major leagues. So this wasn't really as obvious at the time as it looks to us today. But Gillick was willing to take the chance. It cost a lot of money for a team at the time, and obviously that helped that 2001 team and the Mariners for a long time. The other thing that he did is although one of the downfalls of signing guys is that you can't sign, is that you don't have a lot of first-round picks. You lose your first-round picks. But he continued to be active internationally while he was there to restock the farm system, even without first-round picks, signing Sinshu Chu, Jose Lopez, Felix Hernandez, and Asdrubal Carrera. This is a pretty good haul for a couple-of-year period when you don't have any first-round draft picks. So he continued to look everywhere and have his scouts looking everywhere. In Philadelphia, after he got tired in Seattle, he got tired of the ownership there. He went to Philadelphia. Again, in Philadelphia, he had a solid core, obviously, Ryan Howard and Chase Utley. It was a pretty good team. And again, he recognized exactly what they needed. Jason Worth, for example, another guy that he had in Baltimore. Worth had been injured for a while. He signed him as a free agent, but Worth had actually been in the Oriole organization when he had been there. So he had guys that he knew he liked, and those are the guys he went after. And then after the 2007 season, he got Brad Lidge without really surrendering any of his key players. Lidge obviously had that great year. So here's what he did here is he was filling in around the core. But again, he was looking for players that he knew and liked and could find. So to wrap up, Gillick's approach to building a baseball team was to have an obsessive search for the best players and look everywhere. So great scouts, but again, Rule 5 draft. Any other draft you can find. Look in Japan. Create the first Dominican Academy. So Gillick's approach was, again, fish in many rivers. Thank you.
If you have any questions for Dan, come up to the microphone so the audience can hear your question.
Before the questions, one shameless plug. So our book, In Pursuit of Penance, that Mark Armour and I did, we are actually going to, if anyone's interested, we are going to be signing the book downstairs in the vendor room after this presentation. So thank you.
I have a question. Who was his mentor? And also, who did he mentor? Are there people out there now that he kind of brought along?
He played baseball at USC with Rod Dedeo, so obviously there was a certain mentorship there. Eddie Robinson was the fellow who signed him in Houston, and I think he had a pretty close relationship with Eddie Robinson. From him mentoring other people, it's not quite as clear exactly who he mentored. Kevin Malone was with him in Baltimore, but I don't think you can look so closely today and say this is somebody he mentored.
Certainly not Ruben Amaro Jr. Two things. One of the, I guess, the Rule 5 guys for the Phillies worked out was Shane Victorino. And also, how did he get the kind of derisive nickname Stan Pat? I mean, he did make some trades, but a lot of people felt like he didn't make enough trades.
Well, two things. One, Shane Victorino came to the Phillies before he got there. So he didn't really get credit from it. You're right. Victorino was a Rule 5 guy on the Phillies. There was sort of these funny periods where he didn't make any moves. I think for like calendar year 1988, I'd have to go back, it's in the book, but he didn't make any moves. There were sort of these funny periods where he didn't make any moves. I think for a while he was trying to just build up the Blue Jays talent. He wasn't so much trying to, tweak it at midseason to necessarily win the division and the pennant. Once he got past that, then he started making more moves because he was trying to sort of fill in. And I think one of the things I want to say is what the owners, I mean, he had a specific charge in different places. With the Blue Jays organization, he was building an organization of young players. With the Orioles and the Mariners, he was trying to fill in and win a pennant now for a team that had a new stadium.
Dan, Gillick is still active to a degree with Philadelphia. Is he going to continue in a role like that going forward, particularly with the Phillies needing rebuilding?
With the Phillies not being good going forward?
Well, no, Gillick, he's still active to a degree with Philadelphia in an advisory role. Is he going to continue with that?
Well, my understanding of him in Philadelphia is he was sort of in an advisory role till Dave Montgomery got sick, and then he came back and was sort of the acting president. My sense is that he is much more of just sort of working at this level as opposed to being involved at all in the player acquisition stuff.
When he was looking to evaluate players, was he looking for the high-ceiling guys who he thought then could, the tools guys who he then thought could be brought in and trained to play baseball, people like Ainge and others of that type? Is that something that was part of his style?
I think it was sort of interesting. I think Gillick was a tools guy for the young guys who he wanted to have the high ceiling. But when he was filling in around, when he had the core and he was trying to fill in around, he was very much looking for chemistry guys, too. He often talked about chemistry in the clubhouse. And so I think that there was sort of a dual thing going on. He wanted the young guys to be high ceiling. But he was also looking for a different kind of guy when he was trying to fill in around him. Jason Wirth, for example.
One thing I've noticed is Gillick's teams always fall off a cliff when he leaves. And is that part of his effect on the organization? Or is it because he's so good and the next guy, obviously, in Philly, is not as good?
Well, that's a complicated question. I think, if you win 11, if you're winning 86 games for 11 straight years, to some degree, there's going to be some fall off. But I think he left that farm system in pretty good shape. I think the Phillies, he really retired after 2008, and I think they were the last team to win 100 games in 2011. So that's a pretty decent-sized tail to a certain degree. And then I'd say that in Baltimore and Seattle, I think in Seattle he left pretty good talent, but the next GM wasn't Pat Gillick. Baltimore, there's no question that he had signed a bunch of guys to three-year contracts. He took over a team that was already exceptionally old. That Baltimore team in the mid-90s was really one of the oldest pennant-winning teams ever, and I just think that there was not a whole lot you could do. His charge was to win now, and that's what he tried to do.
I'm from the Northwest, and when both Griffey and Rodriguez left town, he kind of said that they didn't have the guts to hit a tougher hitter's park, Safeco, etc. To me, it seemed like real sour grapes. Don't know if you have a comment on that.
I didn't see those quotes. It wouldn't shock me if he said them. I didn't see them. But I guess I'd be a little bit surprised if he said that. I mean, Griffey, they knew he wanted to leave, and Rodriguez, 3 years, $60 million versus 10 years, $252 million. It's kind of hard to put that on not wanting to hit in Safeco. So I don't know.
I just wanted to kind of follow up on the previous question about how Gillick's teams, after he leaves or after he takes, you know, some time off, they kind of fall off the cliff. Does that have anything to do with, say, like the intransigent sort of ownership that he's had to deal with? You mentioned particularly in Seattle, Nintendo of America, at least that I understood, was kind of, you know, pushing back on his style. Do you think that that's kind of like a theme in his career?
I think, you know, the teams hired him for the quick fix in Baltimore and Seattle, and that's kind of what he gave them, and he gave it to them really well. I mean, you had teams below 500. The payroll didn't really go up with Griffey coming off. Baseball America, and I think this is, they were like 24th, their farm system. So Seattle, before he took over Seattle, had traded 7 first-round draft picks in 26 months between 1995 and 1997 to try, basically for guys like Heathcliff Slocombe, to try and win a pennant in the mid-90s. So the farm system when he got there was denuded. So the fact that he signed those 4 guys, I think Baseball America ranked him 24th when he got there at their farm system, and 12th when he left. So he left a decent farm system. He left some guys there. You know, if they ended up giving away Sin Shu Chu, I mean, that's hard to blame on Gillick. But clearly, he had a different charge there than he had with the Blue Jays.
Okay. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.